House State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, May 6, 1991. The time is 8:45. We have a quorum president, Representatives Moyer, Choquette, Baker, and Covina. Today we'll be hearing a continuation of confirmation hearings on Millie Keller, Commissioner Designate for the Department of Administration, and we'll also afterwards be hearing House Bill 6266 relating to BIA contract school employment. This time I'd like to invite the commissioner to come up. Would note for the record, we are also joined by Representative Kay Brown. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Cornell is also here with us this morning. Well, since the last time, some things have happened on SBS. Why don't we start with that? Can you tell us where we're at? I have heard some things on the radio.
We had a meeting with the PERS board on Friday to adopt the necessary emergency regulations so that we could proceed with the dispersing of lump sum payments. And the reason for that is that the PERS board, in order for us to begin the disbursements, we had been notified by the accounting experts that we advise us that as of April 11th that we should we have to separately classify the executive life assets because we have what they call material knowledge of a significant event regarding the value of those assets. Their recommendation is that the most prudent course is to value them at zero until there is an actual evaluation, given all the uncertainties. The way that those, so we, at that point, had to get the PERS board to adopt some regulations as to how we should disperse the lump sum payments that were pending. The PERS board met on Friday and adopted an emergency regulation, in effect declaring an emergency in progress since or as of May 3rd. So all applications that have been made for lump sum distributions through May 3rd will be distributed at 100%. All distributions after that, all applications after that, approved applications, will be distributed at approximately 80%, with the 20% frozen until the value of the executive life assets are determined. Now, the things that will affect the value of those executive life assets are, first, if the legislature appropriates money to make SBS whole, that would, in effect, turn the value of those assets from zero to $132 million. The other events that would change the value will be involved in litigation, either seeking recovery from parties that may have some responsibility to indemnify the state. There's a possibility the state of California has some liability because they allowed executive life to get into the position they're in. And finally, through a liquidation of executive life, the assets, executive life assets, would be, and the GIC holders like us would attempt to recover some value from a liquidation. All of those, we think, are horizon type issues. It'll be a long time before we work out those issues, just because of the complex nature and the nationwide problem affecting every state has had some effect on this. So we had a crew of people work an extraordinary schedule on Friday night and Saturday, so that we could process all of the April list that had been held up pending the PERS board. We had pre-prepared express mail envelopes so that we could distribute the checks as quickly as possible. They were delivered to the post office about 2 o'clock on Saturday, and I don't think express mail delivers on Sunday, but they should deliver on Monday. All of those should be delivered today or tomorrow, depending on where they are. A lot of the checks, of course, go out of state because retirees don't choose to live in Alaska, so that they're nobody, I think, or everybody who was on the April list should have a check by Tuesday at the latest.
Yeah, the record should show that we've been joined by Representative Bruckman. So everybody that has already applied is going to get their lump sum. Now, there is a group of people that get an annuity directly from an executive life, and their checks have been reduced.
Right. That was done by the state of California, and last week there was legal action brought in, and I think in California. The state of California was had taken action to reduce them below that, and there was a court order that requires the state of California to disperse at 70% on annuities. We checked with the Division of Insurance in the state of Alaska. All states have a an insurance fund to make whole any life insurance or annuity type policy that suffers a default because of an insurance company default. And it's our understanding that the state of Alaska's insurance fund will pay any shortfall on an executive life annuity that is reduced. The unfortunate thing is that it doesn't happen automatically, so people that end up getting their annuity reduced, first of all, are going to hear about it from the state of California rather than executive life, and that is going to be a problem just in terms of the mechanics of how they do that, because that hasn't been clearly defined as to how people will be notified that their annuity is being reduced. They then have to apply to the state. Although I think the state, once it finds out what the state of California is going to do, the state of Alaska would be able to step in. There are about, my recollection, 150 to 200 executive life annuities for state retirees that will be affected by this. But the state's insurance fund will guarantee up to 100% on those at a maximum of $100,000, as I understand it. And I don't think any of them will be over $100,000. So even if the state of California completely defaulted on them, there should be enough to make those annuities whole.
Okay, so that reduction in that annuity is really not tied into our loss on the junk bonds, our $132 million. It's just their overall thing. They did get their checks in this last week. I know a number of people did that were reduced.
Okay.
So we'll be moving to make those. That may be reduced forever. That's all up to the state of California.
It just depends on how they work out their problem. They're seeking somebody, a new investor group, to come in and take over executive life. And the thing that they're interested in, of course, is making all of their insurance policy and annuity policy holders whole, because the state of California's insurance fund is supposed to step in on these as well.
What about our insurance now for the $132 million? Do we have an insurance policy that may cover some of that?
No.
No.
No, the only, making the system whole is going to require an appropriation. And we are scheduled to meet on Thursday with the Legislative Budget and Audit to go over committee substitutes to, I believe it's SB 204 and HB 221.
Do you know what your recommendation will be?
Well, it's going to be an appropriation-oriented recommendation. Previously, before the collapse on April 11th, the state could have handled it as an investment decision. And the original bill was essentially authorizing the general fund to make an imprudent investment. And that imprudent investment was to buy the GICs from SBS at their full value. That can't happen anymore because of April 11th. They don't have any value anymore until the value can be determined. So now it's going to require an appropriation from the general fund. And it's $132 million, so you can see that this isn't going to be an easy piece of legislation to fashion and get general support for, because it's going to involve taking $132 million out of, or reducing current appropriations by $132 million.
But that will be your recommendation for us to actually fund the full amount this year before we leave here.
Well, I think we've got to come to a consensus. We don't have a strong position. We want to work out a solution. And I don't think we're, so far, that the way the legislation has been fashioned has been in kind of a collegial environment. We've got the parties to agree this is acceptable to them and this is acceptable to us. There have been lots of alternatives, one of which was to fund it in a manner that the Science and Technology Fund was done over a period, a kind of installment payment. And that appears to probably be the easiest way in terms of having an effect on the general fund. As I understand, there are some constitutional problems in writing a legislation like that because it can't become a continuing appropriation. It has to be specified so that it turns out to be a real appropriation and not a dedicated fund.
Is the legal opinions that have come out that are available for public debate indicate that we should be making this fund whole, or is this a subject that is not open for public debate yet? Or
no, we're not prepared to discuss that in public. Although I think the meeting we had 2 weeks ago on Friday with the House Finance Committee, and then tomorrow, we'll have an executive session to explore the liability issues. The direction we're going, I think, is that it may not be necessary to proclaim our legal position, but the legislation will, in effect, be the policy statement that the legislature and the governor make regarding how to do this without having to go through divulging any kind of legal strategy that could be used against us or that we could use against another party.
Have you, after being involved in this, the records should show that we've been doing by Representative Grunberg. Have you, after a couple of weeks here since you were last before us, we kind of debated this issue whether we had a moral right, a legal right, and whatnot. Have you changed your mind at all on there? I'm trying to think exactly what you said back then, I guess.
Well, I've thought a lot about it. And I mean, thought a lot about it sincerely, just because it was, in a meeting like this, when you start debating fine points of philosophy, it was a very reflective question. And I don't think there's any question that we recognize, all of us, including the legislature and the executive branch and people that have been involved in it for a long time, that we have an obligation to try to correct the problem. And there are ways to do that. We can do it through appropriation, which will have a significant effect on other things that the state wants, that you want to appropriate for, because it's going to mean having to reduce appropriation somewhere else. We have legal remedies that we can go after. And I think from the very beginning we inherited this problem in December, and we immediately recognized that we had to do something about it. So I think in terms of making a moral commitment to try to work this thing out, we've done that from the day we came in. So to the extent that that involves a moral obligation, I think we've performed. And our actions have really demonstrated our moral commitment to do this. We're coming up now to the point where we have to make a legal commitment. And I think that was the point that we got on, that the fund doesn't get made whole by a moral commitment, it's going to get made whole by a legal commitment. And that is going to be a very difficult decision for all parties, because it involves, it's going to have a substantial impact on the current budget, the FY92 budget.
If the legislature doesn't act to appropriate money during this session, then you would assume that this 80% payout would remain in effect for probably this full year, unless circumstances change some other way. But if we did appropriate the money, then you would see that that would immediately, no individuals would immediately be affected.
Right. Our plan is that the May list, which would be the one that's in effect of people that weren't on the April list but made applications and are now on the May list, would normally be, those checks normally be produced around the second or third week in May. Our hope is that if the matter is resolved between now and then through an appropriation, that those will be 100% checks and everything else will be from then on, so we won't have to ever give anybody a reduced check, because as of now, we have not given anything other than 100% lump sum payment.
The people that have getting annuities from, I think it's New York Life, they're not affected at all.
No. They will be if we have to reduce, if the appropriation isn't in place by the time we do the May list, and anybody applied after May 3rd.
But the ones are already getting it. That'd never be reduced.
Right, no, those won't be reduced.
Okay, that's it for me. Resident Brown?
Just one on that point. So Commissioner, what is your position with respect to the interest that employee accounts would have been earning on the $132 million?
Well, we're going to lay a range out of options for the legislature to consider. We've looked at everything from the frozen part, paying no interest until the value is determined, so that there's no interest being accrued on the frozen part until we determine what the value is, to paying and accruing interest on the frozen part. I think realistically the easiest way to do it is to look at it as you would a legal settlement. For example, if there's a liability issue and you settle and you determine that on the date of the accident, for example, if it's an insurance claim or something, on the date of the accident that the insurance company should have paid you $10,000 and it took you 6 months to settle, and they pay you interest as part of the settlement. They owe you $10,000 plus interest on $10,000 through today. And I think that's probably the way we'll fashion this, is that the frozen amount at the time that the values are determined will then determine what the interest will be paid on the frozen amount and include it as part of the overall package. The question is going to be, what interest would you charge? I don't think, well, on the upside, you could say, well, we'll charge the executive life interest all the way through. I think that one is questionable in that if you're going to, based on what happened to the executive life asset. But on the other side, you could say, if we had put this money into treasury bills instead of executive life GICs, we wouldn't have had to bail it out. But the interest rates you would have been getting would have been the treasury bill rate rather than executive life junk bond rate. So that on the downside, there might be a case to pay the treasury bill rate during this frozen period, something like that.
But you do believe some payment of interest is appropriate under the circumstances?
I think it is. I think most settlements, when you make a settlement that down the road, that you recognize that interest was due on that amount. You froze it on as of May 3rd is what it amounts to. And if later on you determine that it really is worth 100% during that period, then you should pay interest during that period.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee?
You almost caught us off guard.
I talked too long.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
I
believe last time we were here, Commissioner, we spoke of centralizing personnel functions. I don't mean to repeat any of that, but rather what your plans might be in the area of centralizing budgeteer and pulling in finance offices from various departments.
I don't have any plans in that regard. But I think as we look at all of the organizational aspects of state government, we'll look at all of the, and I believe the place that we start is looking at how far authorities have been delegated and to see if they're at the appropriate level. In many ways, OMB has a very centralized function now. I was surprised, in fact, that at the end of the budget process, I think you can make a strong case that it may be too centralized in some of the decisions that OMB makes. In an overall organization, when you see as much responsibility delegated out into 15 departments, and there's good reasons to do that. Part of it is responsiveness, and there are some good reasons. But on the other hand, you pay a price for that. In decentralizing, you tend to have a more of a bureaucratic structure, so that in some ways controls are reduced. I think we'll look at all of those issues in terms of general streamlining government.
Record should show that we have been joined by Representative Mackey. Representative Moyer. Well, let me ask you about the regulations. A new governor has come out, issued, I guess, a letter to the lieutenant governor, giving him some much broader authority than has been done in the past. Some people claim that the authority goes beyond what is statutorily allowed. Have you had any input into this process?
No, I haven't. And I haven't even looked at the statutory implications. Just in terms of the letter, it didn't seem to me like it was that big of a deal. It's more of a paperwork flow issue rather than some kind of radical departure from the practices of the past. So I may have missed something very subtle there, but it looked to me like it was more of a way to reroute the paperwork.
Well, actually, as my understanding is, it used to be the commissioners of the departments are the ones that approved regulations, and now we have a lieutenant governor that's really going to approve all regulations, and that's obviously a given. I mean, we write laws, but really everybody knows that how the regulations are written is really going to determine how those laws are put into effect. So it is quite a power position, I would say, to be able to unilaterally rewrite every regulation that there is in the department. It's quite a thing there. Anyways, we have, if you had no input into it, I guess, you're going to have to send regulations to you that he's going to have to approve. Does this bother you that someone is usurping your authority here?
No, I think there already was an approval. I'm not sure that I had unfettered right to change regulations because they have to go through the Attorney General. And I'm not sure that there's any problem in running them through Lieutenant Governor. He certainly has a lot more experience in government than I have. And just having him personally look over my shoulder on a lot of these things doesn't bother me at all. I didn't interpret that he's going to write regulations, and I don't think he wants to write regulations. I think his role is just to be able to monitor the process, maybe even streamline the process to some extent, so that just the taking advantage of his experience in government, I think could be an advantage.
That'll be interesting. I'm not sure that's the way I interpreted what he was going to do, but. Representative Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chichelle, we've been joined by Representative Mackey.
That's twice.
Thanks,
Mr. Chairman.
And you know, he likes the press, so you've got to get him to take as much of the funnel out of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been given, Mr. Keller, your conflict of interest statement. And I was looking at it last night. The form, and I had never noticed this before, does not really require you to list stocks and bonds and corporate securities that you may own. Would you give us, if you can, any corporate stocks, bonds, debentures, and other securities you own?
I don't own any.
Do you have any options?
Nothing listed there.
Do you have any options?
No, I don't.
Okay. And have you within the last 5 years?
Within the last 5 years, I have. But as many people in Alaska did, they sold a good number of their assets to pay off their liabilities. And I'm one of those people.
Let me say, within the last 12 months.
No.
Okay. You, at our request, I think it may have been even my request, provided us with some Commonwealth North right. documents. I've received two of those. I'm wondering, the one is entitled The Challenge of Wealth Management, and the other is entitled Alaska's Budget Crisis Facing the Facts Closing the Gap. Were you the author of those?
Yes, sir. I was chairman of the committee, the committee that drafted on the wealth management. That was part of the Compass North piece that we did in the mid-'80s, and I was chairman of that committee that wrote that report. The budget crisis was a committee that was formed, I believe, when Governor Sheffield was faced with the first tremendous budget crisis that hit us when the price of oil fell below $10 a barrel. And we fashioned a plan as to how the state could make a soft landing by 1990. There's a third report that I did in 1980 that a committee did, and I was chairman of the committee and drafted the report on the promise of a petrochemical industry in Alaska, and I did send that over, but there probably wasn't time to get a copy.
No, I haven't received that anyway. With respect to the document entitled The Challenge of Wealth Management, page 90 for example, and this appears also throughout the other document as well. Talk about the lack of capital investments within Alaska that can help generate revenue. It looks to me like the types of capital that you're seeking to build here or develop are those that are revenue generating. Is that correct?
Yes. I think we're mostly interested in public and private investments that have the ability to create wealth, create jobs, and create economic activity.
The administration's proposals, though, we just heard on the governor's package last Friday, I believe, with Mr. Stastny and his assistant, don't limit the capital concept to those that are simply revenue generating. Has the administration changed its focus, specifically broadened the focus from those capital investments that are revenue generating to all capital investments?
Well, I don't think there's a change. That particular focus was on the kind of investments that that create economic activity. For example, investing in oil development, investing in pipelines, investing in roads, and so forth. But we've all along been very supportive of all kinds of capital investments. For example, the if anything, we broadened the concept to include the debt issue, and that report also gets into the debt management issue. But I don't see it as a change. Maybe if you, we've always been supportive of capital projects
I'm not
revenue generating.
My question is, was there a change? I didn't mean to necessarily imply that there was, but reading both of these documents, the only types of capital investments that seemed to be mentioned were those that generate revenue. And I'm wondering, I was wondering the reason for the apparent difference, and you've gone a little way towards explaining it now. Am I correct that the reason you put that in here, because those were the only capital investments that were relevant to that particular discussion?
Right. In the wealth management issue, we were looking at investments that tend to have this wealth component to them.
Okay. Again, I'm focusing first on the wealth management document, then I'll get into the other one. When you opened your discussion with us last time we visited, you were indicating that you felt that the main purpose of the permanent fund was to generate dividends for the people.
I think that's become the purpose of the fund by default. There's no purpose defined in law other than what the legislature has done in terms of what to do with the earnings. And the only statement that the legislature has made is that the earnings of the fund are used to pay dividends and inflation proof. And I think that has been in place now for almost 10 years, or 8 to 10 years. I think inflation proofing may have come on later. But in effect, I think now those, unless the legislature changes the policy, those have become the de facto purposes of the permanent fund. There have been some deviations. For example, the legislature may have appropriated money to pay prisoners when they leave and so forth, but those have been extinguished pretty quickly, at least as an observer, that the public has pretty much convinced the legislature that that's not how they want the permanent fund used. They want it used for inflation proofing and dividends.
But here, at page 100, you stated that, and I'm looking at the last paragraph on here, the only certainty is that the permanent fund is a true state savings account. Have you come to change your mind from that statement, or is that still accurate?
If anything, it's of all the things, actions the state has done that signify what an owner state is, the permanent fund comes the closest to being the definition of an owner state. We have 500 and some thousand recipients of dividends from the permanent fund. Each of those people, it's a savings account to them. They get earnings off that savings account every year, and it's distributed democratically to all citizens of the state.
Well, let me make my question a little more specific. The concept of a, quote, true state savings account, unquote, I think is somewhat at odds with the statement that the main purpose of the fund is to distribute the dividends. Do you find those statements somewhat in conflict?
No, I don't. The only thing I would see is if you had legislation that was appropriating the earnings from the permit fund to some other purpose, like paying prisoners money when they leave prison, or paying, creating an endowment fund for government spending. But you haven't done that. The legislature hasn't taken those particular actions. They've pretty much left it as a savings account with this built-in inflation proofing as a way to increase the size of this of the piggy bank. But it's for all intents and purposes a savings account.
The reason I'm asking is because, as you know, when someone invests, and you're one of the trustees on the fund, there are different kinds of investments one can make. One is a type of investment that will yield an income stream. That is useful when you wish to pay dividends. Another is a type that will increase the capital, and that's useful when you want to save the capital. What's your philosophy? Which way should this fund be used?
Well, both. Clearly, that is the intention of the trustees, and the management of the fund is to do both. We want to increase the principal of the fund through capital appreciation. The fund has expanded the amount that it invests in real estate and equities, so that it will have the ability to generate wealth regardless of the contributions from royalties and inflation proofing. At the same time, a large amount of the fund has to be held in short-term securities because of this tremendous cash requirement that comes up once a year. Because you have to have securities that are going to mature and pay in the neighborhood of $500 million once a year. So that's a lot of cash that has to be, you have to be able to pull out of the fund all at once. So it's doing both.
Do you see in the future, for the next several years, that there should be an effort made to increase as much as possible the size of the dividend, or should we look at a policy that will in effect reduce or stop the growth of the dividend to increase the corpus more? Do you see any change? How do you plan to direct the fund from your role as trustee in that specific respect?
Well, the trustees have voted unanimously at our last two meetings on this general idea, and the idea is that we would like to see the dividends increase.
Is that a change in direction?
I don't think so. I think they've debated on whether on the role of the dividend, but I think the biggest limitation on the dividend, on the growth of the dividend, was what inflation might do to the fund, because if inflation rates get above 4 or 5%, then a larger amount of the earnings has to go to inflation proofing at the expense of the dividend. So to the extent that we had to try to recognize this trade-off, as I understand it, I think the dividends, the percentage of the dividends is actually calculated first. And so there was a concern that by keeping the dividend too generous, that the inflation proofing might suffer. But I think the investments are turning out to be so successful that the strategy that the permanent fund is following now will do both. It will provide for a growth in the dividend and maintain an amount necessary for inflation proofing.
You said that you see that the policies of the permanent fund have been successful so far. Do you think that the staff is a good staff there?
Yes, I do.
Do you plan to see any change in the executive director?
No.
Do you plan to keep Mr. Rose?
I don't have any plans to make any changes. And the trustees, at this point, haven't taken any actions to make any changes there.
Okay.
But he works for the trustees, so...
I understand. Please go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you.
No, that's...
Okay. With respect to... if I may continue, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gibson.
With respect to the other document, the budget crisis document, there are some very specific suggestions, guidelines for future fiscal management. One thing you stated in there was that the state capital budget should never be less than $200 million or the level required for federal matching funds. I assume you mean the greater of the two amounts. That if the federal match is more than $200 million, it should be that, but it shouldn't, even if the federal match is less, go below $200 million. Am I right?
I can't remember the exact details on that. I know the concern was that far and away the largest amount of federal revenue is on the capital side is for highways, and that we wanted to make sure that we are always able to appropriate enough capital so that we can maximize the federal highway funds. $200 million, this was, I think it was written in 1986.
I couldn't.
Those are probably based on numbers that existed in 1986, and I'm not sure what they are now. They're probably about the same, but.
Is it still your view that all loan programs previously supportable at highly subsidized interest rates because of high oil revenues should be revised for phase-out, capping, conversion to market rates, or conversion to a revolving loan fund? This includes the student loan program, ADA and AHFC. Is that still your view?
Right, and I think a lot of those have already done. I know the student loan program was revised after that to make it more of a market-oriented loan. And I think AHFC loans also came closer to being market loans because there are other sources in AHFC now.
Is it still your view that all blanket distribution programs previously supportable because of high oil revenues must be reviewed for phase-out, capping, or conversion to loan or need basis? These programs include the longevity bonus and power cost equalization. Is that still your view?
I think all of those programs have to be reviewed. The budget scrutiny you give every cent that the state spends falls in line with this. I think that those were done in a context that if we were going to try to avoid a hard landing, again, this was based on the fact that we looked at for the first time when this crisis developed, that the state couldn't just count on an unending growth in revenue. That we had to recognize that we are subject to market fluctuations that have a devastating consequence on us. And as such, we need to look at all of our spending.
I'd like to focus on power cost equalization. Is it your view now that that program should be reviewed for possible phase-out capping or conversion to loan or need basis?
I think under all those circumstances, if the alternative is to ignore those programs and just let them keep growing in what I think would be a self-destructive manner, in other words, if you don't acknowledge that you have, as part of the obligation of stewardship, that you have to look at where all the money is being spent, that you're avoiding a significant responsibility. And I see those range of options there as a proven course for policymakers to take.
In power cost equalization?
I think in all government spending, not just power cost equalization, but in all government spending, that you have to look at, is this the appropriate thing to do? Are there better ways to do it?
Are you taking a look at power cost equalization?
I'm not personally looking.
Do you have any plans to do so?
No, it doesn't come out of the Department of Administration budget.
Have you made any recommendations to the governor concerning power cost equalization? Do you plan to do so?
No.
Are you aware of whether the administration has any plans to change power cost equalization?
I'm not aware of any plans other than what's in our budget. The budget that we submitted to the legislature is our plan. But I haven't been involved in any negotiations since then regarding changing that budget.
Is it still you? But it is your view that the power cost equalization plan should be examined for, and I'm using your words, possible phase out, capping, or conversion to a loan or need basis. That is your view.
Well, and also for continuation. I mean, for survival. I mean, I see it. That's my position, is that if we look at all these programs as opposed to ignoring them, I see if what you're trying to say is should we ignore the program and essentially appropriate the funds blindly, I say no, that's not a prudent thing for policymakers to do.
You next had ideas for cutting back the budget, and had a number of ideas. You suggested reducing overtime. How would you reduce overtime? Particularly, and I'm focusing now on some question this committee may recall, the first time we had Commissioner Burden here. Commissioner and Representative Choquette will recall discussions in the Department of Corrections subcommittee where the line departments are caught in a bind. On the one hand, they are required to retain essential services. On the other hand, cut personnel. And one way to do this, if you cut personnel, is to increase the overtime. How do you, Mr. Commissioner, look at resolving the the tension between those two theories?
Well, there will never resolve the tension. I think the tension is always there, and I think it's a healthy tension because you've got a situation where to make good decisions, you're going to have to be willing to test alternatives. In terms of reducing overtime, there's clearly an objective in streamlining government is to try to increase the productivity of government, of any organization. And that, one of the benefits of doing, of increasing productivity is that you reduce overtime. You also reduce the number, or hopefully take advantage of things like attrition and reduce the number of employees at the same time so that the cost of government can be reduced.
But specifically,
you look at contracting out.
I'd like to focus, and I don't want to take, we've got a number of things to cover here. Between the tension between the reduction of overtime and the reduction of the workforce. Do you have an answer on how to do it?
Well, I see it as a productivity. I don't think it's an either or. I think it's, that dynamic is always there. But what you're trying to do is improve productivity. Some of it's through use of technology, some of it's through reorganization. There are a lot of ways to do it, but it's change. No matter how you look at it, it's a change from the way things are done now.
You also urged that the work week be changed back from 37 and a half hours to 40 hours. Is that still your view?
I think I'm strongly inclined to do that, although that is a subject that would be, it's a collective bargaining issue, so it's not something that can be done unilaterally. But that's something, obviously, one of the ways to improve productivity is to try to look at areas where the state may not be as productive as it is because of policies that it's had in the past.
You urge the elimination of merit pay increases. Is that still your view?
I don't think that if it says that I urge the elimination of merit pay increase, that's not,
let me
a mistake.
Let me read you the statement. Eliminate merit pay increases because they have become automatic.
Okay. I would say that's improve the merit evaluation system so that they are meritorious increases. We're required by Constitution to have a system based on merit. I think the issue there is that merit increases no longer are based on merit. There's a concern that merit increases are really seniority increases. And I think that's a legitimate concern on a lot of on the part of the public and on anybody making policy, that do you really have a system based on merit as the Constitution intended?
The next thing you said was discontinue COLA. Is that still your view?
To the extent that COLA conflicts with merit, I think that is something that has to be reviewed, because that's in effect what's happened is that you in my view, a merit system is how you determine what is the basic way that you determine what an increase in compensation will be. You also have other factors like cost of living, which you have to take into account from time to time. But you shouldn't lose sight of a merit system in doing this.
Is that still your view?
I'm not sure eliminate. I think eliminate may be the wrong word because there are pay differentials. But I think, in fact, there's legislation that we introduced to go through the calculation process to make sure that the correct adjustments are made. It could be we want to adjust regional pay differentials to reflect true market rates, but I would say eliminate may not be the right word in that bullet.
You stated you wanted to reduce salaries. Is that still your view?
I think to some extent the state's salary structure, there are areas where reductions should take place. There are also areas where increases should take place. That's true, I think, in any kind of collective bargaining structure where you end up with pay schedules that may end up with people normally on the lower end not keeping up with people on the upper end.
You stated that you wanted to, quote, conform leave and state holidays to national norms. Do you feel that our holiday and leave package is too generous?
I'm not sure about too generous. I would say generous.
Do you think it should be reduced?
I think we should consider making it more, making sure that the benefits that we offer are what would be considered above average to the normal citizen of Alaska. I think it's a lot to ask the citizens of Alaska to pay fringe benefits far beyond what what the, say, the above middle income or the upper middle income type citizen gets. So I think those things are things that we that should always be evaluated.
You stated that you wanted to, quote, conform retirement packages to national norms, unquote. Do you believe that the state retirement package is too generous?
Again, I'm not sure I would say too generous. I would say generous. And I don't think, I've never heard anybody argue that it's not a generous retirement system.
Do you think it should be reduced?
I wouldn't want to reduce it. But I think there are areas that, for its own survival, that we need to make sure we stay on top of. Right now, the state's retirement system is one of the best funded systems in the country. If we were in a situation where we had some actuarial problems, which many political subdivisions, municipal governments have, we'd have to look at that. But our system right now is funded and is actuarially sound, so that the benefits that are being provided now, I don't think pose an extraordinary burden on the actual safety of the fund itself.
You suggested, quote, 100% defunding of all boards and commissions scheduled for sunsetting. Is that still your view?
Let me first of all say that the reason that we did this is that we were facing $10 a barrel oil, and we're looking at the things that you would look at if the price of oil fell to $10.
I understand that, but I think
in the context of my answers, we're giving answers on the basis of $16.50 a barrel oil. I think you should be aware that a lot of these were meant to be areas that need to be scrutinized when we're faced with a disaster.
Yes, I absolutely understand that, and that's why I'm asking if each of these is still in your view. Is that still
if we were faced with $10 a barrel oil, I think we'd have no choice except to look at every board and commission that's going to sunset and say, we better let it sunset unless we can make some very strong case for need, because the alternative is to start cutting off vital services to the public.
I understand, but given the fact that that's not $10 a barrel oil now, is that still your view?
I would hope that we look at every board and commission that sunsets. I mean, there's a good reason that the legislature puts sunset provisions in a board and commission, and part of it is that you're skeptical, I assume, about whether this board or commission is really necessary. So any time a sunset comes up, I would hope that you do scrutinize, as an option, defunding and terminating the board or commission.
Are you having any part in that process now?
No, I don't. There are none of the boards or commissions in the Department administration that are that have sunset provisions in them that I'm aware of, anyway.
No, that's not my question. My specific question is not whether there are boards and commissions in your department. My question is whether you yourself are involved in recommending to the governor that any boards and commissions should be scheduled for sunset.
No, I've not. I've been not involved in those kind of determinations.
Which boards and commissions do you think should be sunsetted, if any?
I can't give you an informed opinion on that. I wish I could, but I haven't looked at that issue of the ones. I think in 1986 when we did this report, that we looked at it more from a policy standpoint, that you're trying to find every area where you could reduce spending. One of them was to take advantage of sunsetting.
You stated that you should, quote, eliminate funding for programs or groups that, as a matter of practice, sue the state of Alaska. What group or groups did you have in mind?
I'm not sure. Actually, that's a good question.
You have no idea?
At the time, now I don't. I think there was some concern that it's not in the state's best interest to give a grant to somebody who's in the process of trying to sue them.
Might this include, for example, occasionally the Public Defender Agency, the Office of Public Advocacy, and Alaska Legal Services?
Well, the Public Defender and OPA don't sue the state. They represent the state. Or they represent individuals, though, but they don't.
They represent the opposite sides of the law.
Yeah, but they don't. That isn't an area where you're. I think these were aimed more at advocacy groups, like an environmental extremist group that was trying to stop development for good and lock up Alaska, that it wouldn't be wise to provide grants to a group like that.
How about Alaska Legal Services?
I don't know that much about how they work or what they do, actually.
You weren't aware that they have been known to sue the state and this was not aimed at them?
I mean this honestly. I know them just vaguely by reputation, but I'm not even sure whether they're federally funded or where they get their money.
Would you favor eliminating funding for Alaska Legal Services?
I don't know that enough about them to answer that.
You also urged eliminate funding for nonprofit groups funded by direct legislative action that are performing services already being performed by other agencies or groups, or go to competitive bidding for these services. Right. What groups did you have in mind, sir?
I don't think we had any groups in mind. We had in mind that if we're faced with $10 a barrel oil, and we have to choose whether we're going to keep troopers and public education going or fund nonprofit groups that are providing duplicative services, that we should not fund the nonprofit groups at $10 a barrel oil.
You urged on page 26 that the legislature should revise the Little Davis-Bacon Act as well as modify the Collective Bargaining Act. Is that still your view?
I don't think that either one of those can be modified. Or necessarily should be, because at the time we wrote this, we didn't make any thorough study other than we were looking at areas. The concern at those times was that if we're faced with $10 a barrel oil and we have to repair our streets or try to engage any kind of public project, what are some of the areas that have a tendency to increase the cost of public projects? Little Davis-Bacon increases the cost of public projects, but there's a social goal aimed at that, and I think it's a desirable goal, and that is that the wages that are paid on public projects are higher than they would be otherwise.
Okay, your final recommendation at page 27, and this will be my final question, Mr. Chairman, is that 20% to 30% of the state's budget should be targeted for capital spending. Mm-hmm. Was this your recommendation when the oil was at $10 a barrel?
I'd have to go back and see what we were looking at. I think was having an operating budget in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion in order to make the soft landing. And on that basis, as far as I can tell, the 20 or 30% must have been our estimate that the capital budget should be $200 or $300 million, which would be 20 or 30%.
So. Thank you. I have nothing
further. Many of the questions that Representative Gruber pointed out to you would deal with the employees and the relationship. Do you support wholeheartedly the collective bargaining process?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Can you support the... If you had the ability to make some of those changes unilaterally as a state, unilaterally as compared to negotiating them, that if you knew you did it unilaterally, it would obviously cause some great problems with your employees being dictated over or something. Do you think it would be better for the state to make the unilateral change or to attempt to do it through the negotiated process so that the employees are involved in the change?
Well, I think we have a legal and moral obligation to adhere to contracts that we've entered into. To take a hypothetical question and say that if we didn't have to follow contracts and the law, would something or other be acceptable? I'm not sure how to respond to that because it would never happen. I think anything that involves amending a relationship that's established by contract or law, we have the obligation and the duty to sit down and negotiate those changes.
Let me put it in a different light then. You have a bill in that on area cost differential. My understanding on that bill is it would take it out of the collective bargaining process. Say that is non-negotiable. What would be the reason to dictate that this is a non-negotiable item rather than going through the negotiating process and getting your facts in order to change the differential to a more equitable system than what you may think it is presently there? In other words, why try to get a bill passed that is going to dictate to people you can't talk about this in negotiations anymore instead of going in and doing some negotiations?
Well, I think my experience has been that you have to very clearly define what management's rights are, because that's our responsibility in a collective bargaining process, is to represent the citizens of the state. The in the collective bargaining. We don't represent the employees. They're represented by a union. And that's the way the collective bargaining sets up that kind of dynamic. And the two parties work together to come up with a solution. Now, the problem that we have on management side, and I place the legislature on management side as well, I mean, we're essentially representing the public, is that we have to make sure that if certain things that management has a right to are preserved, because otherwise we concede everything to the union, and which are willing to negotiate everything, including some fundamental management rights. The geographic differential is an item that's based on factual information. It's not, you can't go in and negotiate what the cost of living or the cost of food in Nome or Fairbanks is. It's based on a factual determination. So I'm not sure that that is something that you would negotiate as to what the geographic differential is. You might negotiate in terms of who gets the geographic differential or under what conditions people will get it. But the actual determination of the geographic differential, I think, is...
Is it negotiated now?
I don't know.
Okay, I represent Ruckman, Representative Brown, and Representative Mackey. Representative Ruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you said you supported the right collective bargaining process, but I recall that you discussing that you somewhat disapproved of blaming arbitration. So I'm a little confused. I'm also a little confused because I think the legislature represents all the citizens of Alaska, and I think employees are some of those citizens. So it's not real clear. You know, we don't take sides, or shouldn't, in my opinion, as clearly as I think you think. Could you go into your feelings about blaming arbitration and the right to strike? And as a commissioner, would you support the binding arbitration that some employees now have?
Well, first of all, unless the law's changed, we have binding arbitration in certain cases, and we have the right to strike in certain cases. So I might not agree with that, and if I don't, I would try to influence legislators to change the law. But that's the law right now. With regard to our rights, in terms of who we represent, the employees are part of the overall citizens. I don't disagree with that. When you're in collective bargaining, and having been on the school district and had to deal with this in a very close manner, where you have the executive responsibility, very, very much like we have now, you have to be protective and recognize where management's role ends and the union's role in terms of representing those employees starts. And that's part of that I see as a healthy dynamic tension that collective bargaining imposes. Collective bargaining is not a conciliatory process. I don't see it as a thing based on consensus, and it's a process that's based on confrontation. And I think the union recognizes that, and I think management recognizes that. And so you have this confrontational process, and you, on that basis, negotiate solutions that both sides will live with. But it's not a collegial committee-type consensus-oriented where everybody ends up agreeing on every point. I do have some strong opinions on, or concerns about binding arbitration, in allowing a non-elected official to make a fundamental public policy determination that influences the services that the government will provide and the costs that the government will incur, and not having an elected official able to say that's not the way it should be, gives me some problems. And I've written about that over the years in terms of, I see that as elected officials conceding a responsibility that the public gave to them.
As commissioner, then, what are your plans in that direction? You have felt quite strongly on that subject over the years. What are your plans?
At this time, we don't have any. We haven't introduced, and I haven't proposed any legislation to change the process that we have now. I think a lot of it is just coming to grips with how the process works, and then determining what I think are appropriate changes that should be made or could be made.
So you would see down the road where you would come up with appropriate changes and suggestions?
I think we'll probably at some point make some recommendations, just because the I don't think we're going to see a satisfactory outcome after we go through all of the negotiations, just the without somewhere coming to determination that binding arbitration is satisfactory or it's not satisfactory. And I don't think, it's my judgment, that the history indicates that the public is well served by binding arbitration.
Then would you support the right to strike in the cases that you didn't support binding arbitration?
I think that would depend on the situation. The situation now, I think, has an adequate determination of giving the right to strike to employees that don't have binding arbitration. But the right to strike also has some other implications. One of the things is we tend to think of strike rights as some kind of constitutional right. It isn't a constitutional right. The only reason that public employees have a right to strike in Alaska is because the legislature enacted a law that gave them essentially the privilege to strike. And that's based on, that's a U.S. constitutional precedent that says until a state legislature gives public employees the right to strike, they don't have the right to strike. And I think there are still 18 or 20 states that have never enacted legislation of that nature. In Alaska, we have. We've given the right to strike to certain employees, and those that we haven't given the right to strike to, we've given binding arbitration.
You've been acting as director of retirement benefits, in a sense, making decisions. Are you going to continue in that then, or?
Well, no. We have a director of retirement benefits who's doing an excellent job.
Okay. But following the SBS scenario, it seems that you've stepped in, and I wanted to.
Only from the standpoint that, in terms of resolving. Trying to make the system whole, but in terms of actually getting the record keeping up to date, dealing with the PERS board and so forth, that's the director has been doing that, and he's done an outstanding job. When we came in on December 3rd, you could not, if you were an employee and wanted to know your balance in the SBS fund, they could not tell you what your balance was. Not only were the balances inaccurate, but there was not a process in place for updating the records. So that the system was, in effect, getting worse rather than getting better. Since we came in, you can now get an accurate balance on your records, on an SBS balance. We have an ongoing process so that the records will stay accurate. And we're going back and essentially bringing forward all of the records from the past so that the system can be audited. In 1990, the system was unauditable a year ago, and Coopers & Lybrand was not able to perform an audit on the SBS system last year. And that's a dreadful situation when you have a $600 million employee savings plan, investment plan, and it cannot withstand an audit. So we are now at the point where we have that system almost auditable, and Coopers & Lybrand will come in probably this summer and do 1991 audit. The year ends January 31st, but we'll be able to conduct what it's going to amount to a two-year audit, because we'll have to take the year that wasn't audited as well as the current year.
Commissioner, we need to send you to a real good win-win negotiation session workshop here for a couple of weeks. I think that your thoughts on negotiations are far different than mine, and I think that I'm not sure that you're sold on the benefits that could come about from getting rid of this adversarial conflict thought and start working towards things that would be the betterment. You don't have to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to comment, because we have settled with Local 71 since I've been here. We've settled with Master Mates and Pilots, and we're in the process of wrapping up negotiations with MEBA. All have been successful. All have, in my judgment, the process has been working very well, and the track record, just since we've been here, has been a good one. And I think you can talk to the unions, and you'll find out that we are doing a good job. So I think we're on the right track. One of the things you have to, in my judgment, you have to take on is that you, both sides in negotiations, have to be strong. The union doesn't want to come into the table weak. And management shouldn't come into the table weak. You come in with strong positions, you negotiate fairly, and there's a lot of give and take, and both sides respect each other, and they respect each other for their strengths, not for their weaknesses. And we end up with good solutions, and so far we've been doing it.
In that negotiating process, have you felt you've got some concessions out of those contracts that are going to make the state run more efficiently? And what type of salary increases have you guaranteed in those contracts?
Our budget was put together with an assumption of a 5% increase. So we've been using the 5% as a cost factor. And then not all unions want the 5%. There's some other things that they might want in terms of an expanded retirement benefit or whatever. We've worked those around to meet their needs and still meet our needs, and we've been successful. And they've been successful, I think. They've been satisfied with the outcome as well.
In your budget, then, request for next year, will those salary increases probably need to be absorbed within the departments? In other words, you talk about the 5% cut each year. Would that be your intentions when you work up your budget next year?
Yes, it is. And we see the reduction, the opportunity for the state to take advantage of attrition. There are about 2,000 people a year that voluntarily leave employment in the state. We're replacing most of those people in our budget because our reduction is only 600 in total. So clearly there are more people leaving the state voluntarily than are necessary to bring about the 5% reduction. So our plan is to come up with a much clearer strategy in terms of taking advantage of this attrition effect.
So you plan on making up a lot of that money by not only your 5% cut plus your 5% salary increases by having less employees. That'll be where you get most of that. Mm-hmm. And you think that the system will still be able to operate efficiently and perform the services that were needed. And this will be a trend probably over the entire administration's four-year term.
I think we're pretty openly committed. The governor is committed to it in the state of the state, the state of the budget. And I think whenever given the opportunity, he talks about attrition and the need to reduce the number of employees, maintain services, the needed services at their current levels, or even improve. And I've seen that in my own experience that you can bring about an improved level of service with fewer employees. And it's not an easy thing to do. It involves changing the way things are done. But we believe it's a doable task.
It's a tough job. Representative Brown.
Thank you. Commissioner, I'm looking at a column that you authored that was published in the Daily News on December 20th, 87. The title is Political Will Collapses in the Face of Alaska's Public Employee Unions. It starts out saying the current struggle for control of the state public employees union is another example of the damage that has resulted from excessive union influence on state government. Skipping to the bottom, you say, since the legislature is too timid to deal with the issue of repealing the Collective Bargaining Act, the employees may be the best hope the public has. Their willingness to opt out of union control will be directly related to their trust in the political leadership of our state and their respect for the public's interest. This column generally indicates you don't have a very high opinion of unions and their influence in state government. Does this still represent your opinion?
No. First of all, I take issue with the fact that has a reflection on the level of my opinion. As you recall, for about 18 months, as I recall, 12 to 18 months in this period, there were three unions that were contending to represent the majority of the states, the general government. I think it was a general government unit. But there were three unions that were locked in an almost death dance with each other. And the victims, in my judgment, were the employees of the state, because the tension that this caused, and that was part of the reason for this article, was that the unions didn't care about this. In my judgment at that time, were more concerned about winning the battle rather than what state government services are, or whether they should be improved and so forth. And I think it had caused a very serious morale problem in state employees. They were perceived as being more concerned about which union they should affiliate with rather than the services that they would deliver to the public. So that article came about because of that concern. And it seemed to me quite ironic that we're that the citizens were having to do this and the employees were having to do this. And rather than the legislature being timid, it might have been prudent, because the outcome of this was that we don't have to repeal the Collective Bargaining Act, the PARA Act, that the employees themselves could decide whether they want to stay in or out. Because they, when they came time to vote for which of the three unions they wanted to affiliate with, they could also say they don't want to be affiliated with any union. And I think, as I thought about this article and writing through, that the repealing the act isn't the way to make that determination, but I think the employees themselves can make the determination if they want to. I don't think they will. I think the employees will always want to stay in collective bargaining. But they would have a fourth choice, or would have had a fourth choice.
But generally, you've changed your view of the union since you composed this article. Would that be an accurate statement?
I suppose my views have changed to some extent. I don't ever think that I've locked myself into one view and never change. In fact, if anything, I've been accused of too much change, I guess, rather than not enough change.
Mr. Commissioner, with respect to the non-union employees, those not covered by collective bargaining, how will you treat them in these issues of wages, salary, working conditions? Will you continue to follow the general pattern set by the collective bargaining, or will you perhaps make reductions in their wages or benefits in order to achieve your desired reduction in government expenses?
No, I would think that all employees would be treated according to the same policy on wages and benefits. And some of them you're negotiating with, and others are in Title 39 in terms of what benefits they get and the rules and procedures that they're subject to.
And you will continue to look to the collective bargaining packages as appropriate standards for non-covered employees?
I would say the policies, that negotiating policies, when you set out what your expectations are regarding benefits, regarding wage increase levels, that sort of thing, that those same policies will apply to the non-covered people as well.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg has a follow-up on that point.
Well, yeah, just on this article. In the final paragraph of the article, it reads, "Meanwhile, the rhetorical flourishes will continue. The embattled union bosses will dig in their heels, and the rest of us will stand by, bewildered by the fact that this all started because of the 40-hour work week." Do you support the 40-hour work week?
I think it's a desirable goal. Again, it has to be negotiated. I recognize that it's something that would be subject to negotiation, but I support the 40-hour work week.
Would you take the position in negotiations that the employee should work more than 40 hours as a bargaining position?
Not more than 40, no. What I would say is that it's a reasonable position to put out in negotiations, that we would like to bring the public workforce into consonance with the private workforce, so that the public generally perceives state employees as having generally the same kind of rules that they have in terms of benefits and expectations, one of which is a 40-hour work week. I understand, though, that it's an item subject to negotiations, and it's one that I wouldn't go to the bricks over, although I don't want to divulge all negotiating strategy in this meeting, but it's not something that I would see as a life or death issue. But I think it's certainly a reasonable position to put forward in negotiations, the 40-hour week. Now, what happened here was that the state at that time, the Cooper administration, and the state employees were completely taken out of the picture when the three unions started trying to outdo each other in the press with various claims and what I would consider kind of public relations, trying to win the hearts and minds of the union. And you can think back that it wasn't a real good time for the perception of unions making themselves look good or endearing themselves to the public.
I understand, and if you could put me in line for some additional questions.
Representative Brown, would you continue? I'm going to tell you what, we are knocking this off at 10:30, though. We will not go past 10:30. We have session, and I have a bill up on this. Representative Brown.
Thank you. I had maybe a half a dozen questions, Mr. Chairman. Some of them follow up along the budget issues, but I think in view of the time, I'd like to divert for a moment over to the information services area, which is a major responsibility of the Department of Administration. And Mr. Keller, we discussed this very briefly at your last meeting, and you said your basic objection to the Telecommunications Information Council was that it had been and would continue to be a very ineffective organization, but that you didn't have any plans to avoid the legal obligations as far as that body is concerned. My question is, have you taken any action to get a meeting of the Telecommunications Information Council? Have they met yet? Do you have a meeting plan?
We don't have a meeting planned, although we will have a meeting. I mean, I think that's, they're required to meet. There isn't any issue that I see pending that they need to resolve.
Well, Mr. Commissioner, on that point, one of their duties is to adopt regulations implementing the access law, the public access law that was adopted last year. And you and I had some correspondence about that. You indicated in your letter that you intended to have that those regulations developed by the ISC, the Information Services Committee, which is not a statutory group, but rather just a policy group that's created in the executive branch. I think that is certainly a pending issue, and I've recently corresponded with you about items coming across my desk of disputes that are arising out there in the agencies and urging you to use the TIC as an appropriate forum to resolve these. What's your plan with respect to that issue?
Well, I think we could use the TIC to resolve them, but I, at the time we have a meeting, we would want to have our proposal in place and our recommendation in place, because the problem with the TIC is that the people involved, the governor's chairman and so forth, the commissioners as members, are going to be hard pressed to make some of these arcane decisions, and that's why I think it hasn't worked in the past. So you have to make sure that the issue you're presenting to them is an appropriate issue and that you have a recommendation ready to go and that you're even going to get the attendance, because I think, as you recognize in the past, it's been very difficult to get the governor and the commissioners to even attend such a meeting. So part of the problem is that you have to make sure the issue is appropriate and is ready to go, and we're not ready to go on the open access regulations.
Is it your view that information policy is an arcane area that doesn't deserve high-level consideration by the governor and the commissioners as the statute requires?
Not all issues are. Some are. I would consider selecting the appropriate communication switch for the 465 telephone exchange as an arcane issue that I'm not sure that the governor and the commissioners need to be or that it's appropriate for them to decide who has the best PBX proposal for the 465 exchange.
Well,
I would just, you want an example of an arcane issue that may not be appropriate, I'd give you that one.
Well, although, Mr. Commissioner, the statute doesn't address what issues exactly or what level of detail has to be put before the TIC, I don't read this as being optional. I read it as being mandatory that you are required to consult with this group about the broad policy issues. And I think, if I might, Mr. Chairman, the reason that the legislature set up this structure was the recognition that information is, in fact, a very valuable resource. It does cut across not only all departments of government, but all branches of government. And the legislature recognizing that there is a need for coordination if we are to make best use of these resources. I'm really distressed, Commissioner, at your view of this and at your refusal to follow the what I think is a pretty clear direction in the statute, and in fact that you are taking actions to undercut the activities of this group. Do you have any comments on that?
We've talked about this many times before, and we always come to the same point where we have a mutual disagreement. I agree with it as far as meeting the requirements of the law, but I just don't see the TIC as being that forceful, proactive organization that you do. I just don't think it in the past has been effective, and I don't think in the future, given the structure, that it will be effective.
Do you intend to pursue the bill that you shared with me that you've drafted, which basically eliminates the TIC altogether and pulls all of these functions back into the Department of Administration?
I want to pursue that, and I want to pursue it with you as well. We have not introduced it because it turned out to be a much bigger task than we thought in terms of a reform package, but I'm looking at it as a reform, as a better way to achieve the same result. I think we agree with the outcome, it's just how to get there is where we disagree.
Well, I guess I wouldn't agree that it's appropriate to house all of these functions in the Department of Administration, and to give the Department of Administration broad control over the information activities of all the other agencies, and I think that is one reason we do desperately need a TIC, and we do need leadership from your office and the governor's office as well. If I might, Mr. Chairman, diverting to a couple of, go ahead.
On that point, I think we talked about the last time about you reviewing that last report that came out from this group, and if you had any comments on their recommendations, or if you were going to accept some of their recommendations, or what were your plans
with
that report?
No, I reviewed the report, and I agree with all their recommendations. And the only place that there might have been a disagreement was on the chargeback system, because there was a lot of reluctance on their part to actually endorse a chargeback system. But I endorse the chargeback system. I endorse using the mainframe as a system of last resort, which is what they recommend. And we place much more emphasis on the use of micro and mini computers than we do on the use of the mainframe. I agree completely with that. And that's an information systems philosophy that is often debated, but I agree with what they did. I think this was an excellent report that they did as far as a documentation piece about the state's network. If you wanted to find out in any department of the government what kind of networks they have, all these kind of arcane details, this was an outstanding documentation piece. So I don't have any problems at all with the report.
Commissioner, how do you view your role vis-a-vis the other agencies in providing information services? Let's say in the absence of a statute change that repeals the TIC, you, it seems to me, are in a coordinating role, given your duties under the statute and given the authorities retained by the other departments. Do you intend to continue making decisions such as the removal of the VM machine, which is having and continues to have widespread disruptive effects throughout state government?
Well, I agree it has disruptive effects. I think we disagree on the widespread nature. Part of our strategy in getting to the chargeback system is to reduce the cost of the data processing operation so that the rates that we lay back on users are as low as possible. And part of that, we're starting now, is the elimination of the VM machine, the consolidation of onto one mainframe, the 465 telephone switch. All of those are based at reducing our costs as much as possible so that the chargeback system will be easier to accept.
Mr. Chairman, in the subcommittee, we discussed this at some length, and I requested to see from your department an analysis of how it is you feel that this is actually going to save any money. I'm referring here to the shutdown of the VM machine. I've never received an analysis from you that took into account the actual costs incurred by all the other departments that are having to replace, retrain, and find new ways to make up for the loss of this resource. Have you done such an analysis?
We've looked at the information that the other agencies gave us who were concerned about an extraordinary cost. And even if you add all of their costs up, which we think we're going to be able to help them mitigate most, if not all, of those costs. But even if you take their worst case, the savings, and again, you have to look at this over as an investment decision over a period of years, the savings are still in the millions of dollars to the state by the time we get through all of these things.
So the answer is yes, you have done a written analysis on this that says DOT, so much less, DNR, so much less.
No, we haven't. No, all I've done is I've looked at information that they have provided to us. We have not gone through a detail, mostly because a lot of the agencies have accepted what we're doing and why we're doing it.
You don't intend to do any analysis. You're just going to proceed with the shutdown in October.
We're hoping that we can accomplish it by October.
I'd like to go into a couple of other areas. What's your view of program receipts, and how do you view program receipt-funded activities with respect to budget reductions?
The I look at program receipts as an outcome of a marketing effort, where in terms of data processing and telecommunications, if those are the examples you want to use, that we have an obligation to provide a competitive service at a competitive rate and to be reimbursed for that. And to the extent that somebody can get the service at a lower cost, they ought to get it somewhere else rather than from us.
Commissioner, I may not have phrased that well. I was referring to activities within the budget that are program receipt funds. In other words, a board, we were discussing earlier, the boards and commissions, and your general recommendation that boards and commissions were a good place to make reductions. If we have a board that is 100% funded by program receipts, is it still your feeling that that should be eliminated and therefore counted toward the reduction? Is it your general strategy to just reduce without regard to whether activities are funded by program receipts? That's my question.
I think they all should be scrutinized. I don't think just because somebody is funded by program receipts means they're exempted from being asked, can you make your system work better? Can you reduce your costs? Do you need as many employees as you have now? I don't think anybody should be exempted from that. In our first go-around, we didn't spend as much time on program receipt area. But I suspect on the FY93 budget, we will spend more time scrutinizing areas or costs associated with program receipt components.
It appeared to the Finance Committee that there were large reductions made in program receipt areas that were not particularly rational. In other words, when you cut the activity, the cost, you also cut the income, and we just stopped providing the service. And that's your view, that that's a good thing to be doing?
Well, it is if the service isn't a needed or vital service. I mean, you'd have to start with the presumption that if there's a program receipt, that the program has some kind of noble purpose. Well, it may very well be, but maybe it's a service that is really questionable. Maybe it's something that the private sector provides, and the government is in effect competing and to provide the same service, and using program receipts as a way to keep a government program going that could just as well be handled in the private sector. So all I'm saying is that that program receipt areas should be required to justify their programs and their costs, because the other problem is that if you're living off program receipts, it's pretty easy to sometimes raise your rates without having to stand the scrutiny.